microphones are working. This is a new facility at Mellison, so we're all trying it out. So thanks to Mellisons for this. Wayne Swan, I think, makes his third appearance at the Sydney Institute. He was here some years ago. He was here at the towards the end of 2004, and he's back again. He's been a good friend at the Sydney Institute over many years, so we're very happy to have him back. I'll introduce him very briefly. Wayne Swan's been the Shadow Treasurer since 2004, member for Lilly from 1993 to 1996, and again from 1998. Before that, he was State Secretary of the ALP, and he's also been a lecturer in public administration, Queensland University of Technology. But, of course, we know him primarily as a senior ALP politician and as a senior ALP frontbencher, and now in the very important role as Shadow Treasurer, and talking for us tonight on Labor's economic vision for the future. Wayne Swan, welcome.
Well, thank you very much, Gerard and Anne, for extending this invitation to address the Sydney Institute this evening. There's no doubt in my mind that the Sydney Institute is one of the major forums of political debate in Australia today. And Australia needs organisations like the Sydney Institute, because we need more debate about our future. We have a number of organisations, the Fabian Society, represented by Rose Matthews tonight, and many other organisations and new think tanks coming onto the scene. And I'd certainly like to welcome that development. Tonight I want to talk about the political outlook, the long-term economic challenges for Australia, and the positive solutions that Kevin Rudd and Labor are putting forward. Because I think there is a hunger in the community for new ideas and for a fresh start. I think many feel that we have a government whose best years are behind it and whose ideas have suddenly reached their use-by date. Fresh fields of knowledge and debate are opening up across exciting new areas that hold answers to our nation's future, and there is no area perhaps more exciting and challenging in some ways than climate change. And I do intend to talk about that at some length later tonight. I tend to find, as I move around the community, that intelligent and committed Australians are itching for a chance to make a difference. Australians in business, the public service, academia, and the community all have very big contributions to make, but we don't have a government that is listening. Now, Labor, on the other hand, is very keen to listen, and particularly to listen to the best and the brightest. For example, we have opened a dialogue or a new dialogue with the business community through our Council of Business Advisors, chaired by Sir Rod Eddington. And this, more than anything else, tends to symbolise that mood for change in the community. It extends right across the community. It is this fact of people's hopes for something better, rubbing up against the hard reality of a government living in the past, that I think is making this such an interesting time in politics. For Labor, the situation is obviously looking a lot better than it has in recent years. Now, I don't want you to think that I believe that this means we're a shoo-in at the next election, as some people tend to interpret the current opinion polls. I don't believe we're a shoo-in at all. But what I want to say tonight is that we are absolutely determined to win. We don't underestimate the power of the government and the difficulty of dislodging this government, but we are determined to win, and we are determined to win by getting the policy right, but also getting the politics right. We don't want to be involved in a personalised slanging match, impugning people's reputations and putting each other through what is euphemistically called the character test. We don't want to do that, but we intend to stand up to the government, and we are not going to be bullied, and we are not going to be pushed around by the government. When we are going to go out there and refute the misrepresentations that the government makes about us, and I intend to deal with a number of those this evening. Let's take the biggest of those misrepresentations. First of all, they say we're opposed to reform. Then they go on to say that we're too inexperienced to manage the economy. Then they go on to say that we're out of touch with mainstream Australian values, or that we can't be trusted with the future. Well, I want to make this point tonight, and I want to make it very clearly. When it comes to the future of the economy, far from taking a backward step, Labor will be staring the government down and taking on this debate to the maximum extent that we possibly can. because we know that when it comes to building our economic future, there's a very stark difference between the government on one hand and Kevin Rudd and Labor on the other. We know that Australia cannot aspire to the highest living standards without the most skilled and educated workforce. We know that we cannot survive in an increasingly competitive global economy without world-class infrastructure. We know that we cannot emerge further into the global economy without business having competitive tax and regulatory settings. And we also know that we cannot avert the damage that climate change will wreak on the Australian economy without clear and decisive and early action. The point I want to make tonight is that Labor is very much in the future business. And as one commentator wrote this morning, we've become the constructive government, the coalition has become the carping opposition. Now, before I talk about each of these policy solutions in detail, I want to make it very clear that Labor stands ready to take the tough decisions necessary to preserve and enhance future prosperity. Arguably, the toughest economic decisions that have helped set us up for the current prosperity have been made by Labor. This is completely contrary to all of the rhetoric that you'll hear from Howard government ministers. Let's just run through them for a minute. Floating the dollar, bringing down tariffs, deregulating the financial sector, wage restraint through the accord to rebalance the wage and profit shares in the economy and to tackle inflation, retirement income reform, national competition policy, deep cuts in personal and company tax rates, greater autonomy for the Reserve Bank, just to name a few. All very tough and hard Labor reforms. So we took those hard decisions. And the point I want to make about that is that people like Kevin and I lived through and worked on all those reforms, giving us far more experience of what it takes to make tough decisions than Peter Costello had when he started as Treasurer in 1996. So the Howard government is stretching credibility when it claims it supported all of these decisions when it was in opposition. Let's just go through a few. An examination of the parliamentary Hansard reveals the coalition opposed the introduction of the superannuation guarantee, opposed the move from centralised wage fixing to business-level enterprise bargaining, and it opposed the introduction of the assets test on the age pension. So much for the claims of the coalition that they have been on the side of all of those great reforms that have done so much to set this country up for the future. And I'd also like to make the point that more recently Labor has been prepared to support important policy from opposition as well. You won't hear John Howard acknowledging Labor's support for business tax reform, including capital gains tax relief, the establishment of the medium-term fiscal policy framework, and the recent package of superannuation reforms. Our opponents like to define the economic debate also in terms of experience, and I happen to agree that experience is important, but it means little unless it gives you foresight. Experience is not meaningful unless it gives you foresight, a better view of the future, because it is foresight that enables you to anticipate and prepare for the challenges ahead. Because unless you understand the challenges of the future, you can't govern it. And there is plenty of evidence now that this government does not understand the challenges of the future. Just think about it for a minute. Look at their approach to education and training, to human capital. There isn't a human capital agenda. How can you claim to have the experience to deal with the future challenges in this economy, in a globalised economy, if you don't have a human capital agenda? They don't understand that in the modern world, you need modern, world-class infrastructure, competitive and tax and regulatory settings, and finally, in the modern world, you must absolutely understand the importance of climate change. And in all of these areas, it's pretty clear that the Howard government simply doesn't get it. It doesn't understand the magnitude of these challenges and the leadership required to prepare the economy to meet them. Instead, our opponents rest on their laurels and twist the economic debate at every turn to suit their short-term political interest rather than the long-term national interest. They are content to live off the windfall gains of the mining boom and the growth that's coming from nations like China and India and other countries in the region. They've simply run out of reforming ideas and they've started to substitute ideology for innovative thinking. And you can see this perhaps most starkly in terms of their industrial relations agenda, which will do nothing to create additional wealth and could well unravel the gains made through Labor's enterprise bargaining reforms of the 90s. So we can expect to see a lot more of their crude ideology as this campaign goes on, because they are simply not up to the challenges of the future. So I'll turn now to those economic challenges and explain to you how Labor will meet them. And I guess nothing more demonstrates this challenge than the content, I guess, of the Treasurer's intergenerational report, which was released yesterday, something that we support, although we believe it should have went further than it did. And of course, the intergenerational report was prepared by the Department of Treasury. Now, that's a department I've got a lot of respect for. It's done a lot of good things in advising government over the years to lay the foundations for the growth of the modern Australian economy. Treasury has been pivotal in formulating and implementing some of our biggest economic reforms. And I think it would certainly be a very good thing if the government listened more intently and took on board more seriously much more of Treasury advice. Now, the IGR provides a window into the future, but it certainly doesn't provide a complete roadmap. 4 years, four years ago, the first IGR served to highlight the fiscal pressures emerging from an ageing population. And to its credit, the report helped to raise public awareness about matters such as fertility and retirement decisions. And that was certainly a good thing. But the real shame of the IGR, the last one, and this one, is that the Howard government has not been heeding the warnings that are contained within those reports. And chief among them is that our best response to the ageing of the population is a growth agenda which has at its heart lifting productivity. In the end, after you've dealt with participation, you've dealt with the issues of population, the only thing left to lift living standards in the long term is productivity. But it's a word that hasn't passed the Treasurer's lips very often in recent budgets. The importance of the IGR yesterday, and this is tremendously important, is that it confirms almost all of our economic growth in the future must come from productivity gains. And it also confirms that recent productivity growth has been poor. In the latest report, productivity growth has been revised down from 1.7% this decade to 1.5%. Now, to a great extent, all of this has been camouflaged by the mining boom. The mining boom, of course, has supercharged national incomes by something like $55 billion in the last year alone. And the mining boom is accounting for about half of employment growth. But it's very instructive to compare the first 6 years of this decade with the last 6 years of the previous decade. Over the 6 years of this decade, average growth in the volume of our exports fell to under 2%, less than one-third of the growth achieved over the last 6 years of the previous decade. Now, consider that for a moment. Export performance falling in the middle of a mining boom. It says there's a problem. Average annual growth in GDP fell to 3.25% from 4% in the previous 6 years. Similarly, growth in GDP per person, or average living standards, fell to 2% from over 2.5% in the previous 6 years. So our performance has not been up to the mark in the last 6 years. There has been faltering productivity growth, and we've seen that reflected in declining competitiveness when all this has occurred in the middle of a mining boom, which in essence has camouflaged the declining performance. Now, the principal reason for the deterioration in our economic performance has been very simple. It has been declining productivity growth. It is disturbing that in just 6 years we have almost completely lost the relative productivity gains associated with the economic reforms implemented over the last 20 years. It is even more disturbing that this deterioration in our economic performance coincides with the mining boom. And of course, the mining boom demonstrates how much more closely our fortunes are now tied to the region. But relying on the mining boom to continue to drive our economic prosperity is a very risky strategy, but it is the one that the government is relying on. So Labor, looking at all of this material, concludes that we as a country have to make our own luck. And that is what is driving Labor's ambitious reform agenda into the future, and it's what drove it when we were last in power. And what we need to do now is to halt the slide in our productivity performance if we are to avoid a sustained downturn in our rate of growth as the mining boom turns down, which is why Kevin Rudd and Labor have been talking about a new economic strategy. And our strategy starts by recognising that if we are to build long-term prosperity, we must turn around the slide in our recent productivity performance. And of course, what does that boil down to? We need to be investing in the skills and know-how of our people to raise productivity and underpin future growth. We need to build capacity to develop and absorb new technologies so our businesses can be amongst the most innovative and competitive in the world. We need to be investing in world-class communications technology and national infrastructure to provide a platform for future growth and business investment. And we need to ensure that our tax and regulatory regimes do not stifle competition. And of course, we do need to progress the unfinished business of the national competition policy agenda and address the obstacles that are impeding efficient investment in energy and transport markets. This is the policy framework that will promote price stability, meaning the Reserve Bank needs to do less heavy lifting when it comes to interest rates, because this is the agenda by lifting productivity that puts downward pressure on inflation and the long term downward pressure on interest rates. And of course, finally, we need to front up to the challenge of climate change and put in place concrete steps to avert the impact it could have on the Australian economy well into the future. Well, let's just go through those one by one. Let's just start with education. 16 years of growth should have allowed this country to make Australia the most educated and skilled nation on earth. We have missed a marvellous opportunity on the back of the mining boom and recent growth to make that fundamental investment in our human capital to lift our productivity into the future. And this is what all of the figures show. When it comes to investment in education, Australia is at the back of the pack. Overall, we are investing about 5.8% of GDP. That puts us behind 17 other OECD, countries, behind 17 other OECD countries. And in global competitiveness reports on maths and science, education levels here are ranked 29. The point is a very simple one. Australia cannot continue to aspire to be first in prosperity if we're coming 18th and 29th in terms of education and skills. It simply doesn't compute. And this is the area that Kevin Rudd has made very clear will be our first priority. Our first priority to ensure prosperity beyond the mining boom, lifting our investment in the skills and education of our people. And of course, that will require us to stump up some money. And we've made it very clear that we don't intend to stump up that money the easy way. We've made it very clear that we're committed to running very disciplined fiscal policy, to have budgets and surplus on average over the cycle, and to limit tax as a percentage of GDP. And what that means is we have to change priorities in the budget. And change we will, and our first priority must be the education and skills of our people. The Coalition fails to recognise that skills and education are the modern currency in a global economy. Labor faces the future with the foresight that if we don't make these investments, particularly when all of the countries in the region are making them, then we are selling our country short and we are not doing the best for our children. So we see the education revolution as being at the heart of an agenda to build future prosperity beyond the mining boom. And there'll be much more to come here. Already we've announced plans to provide early learning universally to four-year-olds. We've announced plans to improve incentives in the crucial disciplines in maths and science. And Labor is also determined to improve educational outcomes through a whole variety of initiatives, and there'll be a lot more to come. Now that brings us to modern infrastructure, because we have had a debate about infrastructure in recent time, particularly in relation to Kevin Rudd's proposals for broadband. Now, 16 years of growth should have also provided us with a fantastic opportunity to ensure that businesses have the communications infrastructure to compete in the 21st century. But here, like education, we are also lagging behind the world. We're ranked 17 among developed nations for broadband take-up, and a damning 25 in the world for available broadband width. 25 in the world. So we see good broadband infrastructure as being absolutely essential if we're going to compete in the cutthroat global economy and increase our productivity. We simply must do more to improve our broadband speeds. Now, we all know that the Future Fund will be able to comfortably meet public sector superannuation liabilities without the need for additional payments from the surplus after next year. So it makes perfect sense to invest a small proportion of its funds in excess of those needed to meet the public sector liabilities to boost future productivity and wealth. You see, Peter Costello's changed his ground on the Future Fund. At one stage, it was an important means for investing surpluses and the proceeds from asset sales, and that was always important, but it was going to be there for the good of the country in the long term. Suddenly, he's turned it into a superannuation fund. He's turned it into something else. Well, it's fine. If we meet those liabilities, then we should be able to use the proceeds of it for productive investment over and above that. That's why it was called a future fund, because it is your money. It is the money that has been paid by all Australian taxpayers and should be used to lift our productivity and to lift our growth rates long term to ensure prosperity beyond the mining boom. So I've been somewhat astounded by some of the rhetoric that has been coming from the government in this area, and astounded that they should be so dismissive of this idea. Now, last week, and some of you may have read it, my opposite number, the Treasurer, likened Labor's broadband plan to friends who keep holding wild parties in your house who won't clean up and never leave. I don't know whether you read it, but it was fairly humorous. Of course, it was the same old arrogant and shrill Peter Costello, the one that voters dislike so much. It got me thinking, and I thought the refusal of John Howard and Peter Costello to invest in modern infrastructure, I thought about it a bit, and I thought, you know, that really reminds me of another irritating visitor who comes to the house and won't leave. And I think we've all met them. There's the cranky old uncle that turns up, starts yelling at the TV news bulletins, starts remembering things that were much better in the old days. The one who comes in and says that global warming has been thought up by loony leftists. The one who comes in and says that to solve all the problems in the country, perhaps what we need to do is reintroduce conscription. The point is this. John Howard and Peter Costello are simply turning into that cranky old uncle. That cranky old uncle that we're all familiar with, who hasn't got anything positive to say about the future. You know, fair dinkum, they're becoming the Alf Garnetts of Australian politics. And it shows. And you can see it in their desperation. Because they know that we're not going to be around to cope with the consequences of their political indulgence by not acting now, by not acting on climate change, by not acting on broadband. So we're quite happy to have this argument with Peter Costello and John Howard about which party has the experience and the foresight to face the future. We understand the future, and therefore we have the foresight to govern. To govern for the future of this country is to face the problems and put in place ambitious plans to deal with them. That's what made this country great. That's what previous governments from both sides of politics have done. But it is what this government is refusing to do, because it is so desperately trying to avoid a debate, because its record is so thin and patchy when you look over its 10 or 11 long years in power. And I guess there is no issue which more demonstrates that than climate change. I find it completely astonishing that the Treasurer's intergenerational report had virtually nothing to say on climate change, which is arguably the most significant intergenerational issue that this country faces. The most significant. Of course, the ageing of the population is a significant issue, and we should deal with it. But we should also deal with climate change. The Treasurer has had very little to say about it. It wasn't only the 5 pages yesterday in the intergenerational report. The Treasurer, in the last 11 budgets, has never mentioned the word climate change once. And he claims to have the experience to govern this country and deal with these entrenched problems, which are so vital to our future wealth and prosperity. So the government's strategy on climate change has simply been to deny, deflect and delay. They claim to accept the scientific reality of climate change, but refuse to accept that it has any real implications for the Australian economy. They claim that Australia is leading the way, but continue to deflect any responsibility or action to others. They claim to be taking greater steps to adapt to climate change and to be doing more than any country in the world, yet they still haven't ratified the Kyoto Protocol. They still haven't established a national emissions trading system or dealt effectively with renewable energy issues and so on. And that is why it was so pleasing tonight, just so pleasing to see the Business Council of Australia come out and advocate a national emissions trading scheme. And guess what it had in it? It said it needed to have long-term and short-term targets. Last week we heard from the Prime Minister and the Treasurer that anybody, and the Environment Minister, that anybody who adopted targets was going to destroy the economy. Business needs the certainty from government to put in place measures to reduce carbon emissions so we can get on with the job of creating wealth and prosperity and a sustainable environment for the future. That is why the business community, from the Business Roundtable, it is why the CSIRO, it is why the European Community, it is why Governor Schwarzenegger in the US are all dealing with climate change. So hopefully following this proposal from the Business Council, we can get a lot more realism from our Treasurer and our government in dealing with one of these fundamental long-term issues, because climate change is not simply about science. It's also about economic management and our long-term prosperity. And the government simply doesn't get it here. I've had the privilege of meeting Sir Nicholas Stern twice. Once in London in September, October last year, the day he briefed the British Cabinet on his report, and again last week. The thing that everybody knows, and the CSIRO in Australia confirms, is there's no doubt about what's happening with global warming, and there is no doubt that we need to make substantial cuts in carbon emissions. What people have failed to appreciate fully in the past, that this is not just an environmental issue in terms of the quality of life we lead, in terms of our natural environment, it is a fundamental economic issue. And we won't have prosperity and growth in our economy if emissions keep going at the rate they are. So dealing with the consequences of climate change is a fundamental economic issue. And as Stern says, not dealing with it can have the consequence of two world wars and a Great Depression. And when the CSIRO comes to us and says, unless we make some material progress in this area, there will be damage to tourism, there will be damage to agriculture, and we'll have fundamental water problems, we are dealing with a fundamental economic issue which requires a serious response from government, which is why Labor has been so forthright in putting forward our alternative blueprint. We argue we do need to establish a carbon price signal to address existing market failures. We need to encourage innovation and investment in new low carbon technologies. We need to do all of that, and we also need to work cooperatively, particularly with countries in our region, to ensure we get the response we require. And hopefully, as a result of this release from the Business Council today, we see some more realism from the government. Which brings me probably to one more item of policy that I'd like to talk about briefly, and that is trying to put in place a policy framework which will see Sydney as a financial hub for Asia. And this is something I spoke about on my last visit to the Sydney Institute shortly after I was appointed Shadow Treasurer over 2.5 years ago. I think we do have the potential to establish Australia and Sydney in particular as a financial hub for Asia. And it's certainly going to be one of Labor's goals in office. And to achieve it, we will have to sustain and improve industry competitiveness and the trade and investment frameworks that have permitted our success in the global economy. Financial services is an area where we can export so much more. And given our recent trade performance, an area we need to export so much more, along with value-added manufacturing. Most people know that Australia is well placed to be a financial services leader. Australia has more than $1 trillion of funds under management, the fourth largest in the world and the largest in Asia. And of course, Sydney is at the centre of it. The financial services sector in Sydney is about half the size of London's and a third the size of New York. We should aspire to even greater heights, and government policy has a very big part to play. One example I've recently cited is withholding tax on foreign investors in Australian managed funds. I think there's an important initiative we can take there. Another example, and perhaps of greater significance to domestic superannuation funds, is the tax treatment of foreign source income. An impediment to further growing domestic superannuation and its outreach into the global economy is the lack of foreign source income imputation credits. Labor's having a very close look at this initiative. We think it's one practical measure, if it's affordable within our budget framework, which could do a lot to help us further lead the world in financial services and to, if you like, steal a march on competitors in Hong Kong and Singapore and London. So we're looking very closely at the tax arrangements, but we are also looking very closely at regulatory systems to see what works. Because we think that maybe one of the aims of our financial regulators ought to be also that they have a framework which encourages them to export more, to make that part of their purpose. So we think there is a very big agenda out there for Australia to really improve, take on the world in the area of financial services and lift our services exports. Now, in conclusion, let me be very clear about the debate on the economic future of Australia. The Coalition says, and you hear it all of the time, that the economy is their strength. And as soon as the subject is even raised, they say voters will be running back to the government, ignoring its failures, ignoring its tiredness and its arrogance. They will say that they have the experience in office to trump new ideas of the opposition. They will try to create the impression that we must be living in a perpetual one-party state in which the government can never change hands. Well, I want to make it very clear that the government can forget all of that. This is a democracy, and the people sometimes demand change. I don't think that they're going to get away with their glib lines on the economy for too much longer, for many of the reasons that I've outlined tonight. Because the Australian people are becoming increasingly aware that their prosperity must be built beyond the mining boom. And it must be built by a party and a government which is prepared to make the investments in the skills and education of our people, in modern infrastructure, and a government that is absolutely determined to take the economic opportunity of combating climate change and looking at the jobs that come with that. So our education revolution, our commitment to deal with climate change and our commitment to infrastructure is something we will argue continuously between now and the election. Because I think there's a feeling in the Australian community, that the windfall of today must be invested in the things that will give Australia economic advantage into the future. Skills, climate change, infrastructure and tax. And I put it to you that Labor is in tune with the needs of a modern, successful economy, and it's a message that people out there are accepting. And it's one we are going to continue to argue all the way through to polling day. Thank you.
So many thanks to Wayne Swan. So we come to question and discussion time. I should say initially thanks to Mellisons for the use of this fine new facility. Many thanks for that. So question and discussion. Did I interpret a slight change of direction in presenting policy? I think it's fair to say, not of you personally, but of some of your colleagues during the period of Kim Beazley and Simon Crean and Mark Latham, that there wasn't much reference to the economic reform achievements of the Hawke and Keating governments, but tonight towards the end of your speech you focused on that. I mean, is that just a passing comment, or is that something you intend to work on in the period up to the next election?
Well, we've increasingly been taking that issue up in the Parliament. We had that sort of precious moment in the Parliament towards the end of last year where we got up and asked the Prime Minister, who was the Treasurer, and I think it was 1978 when interest rates hit 22%, and there was this vacant look on the Prime Minister's face. The government has made a lot and a lot of distortion of the record of the Keating years. I don't know whether we'll have an interest rate rise tomorrow or not, but whether we do or we don't, already people are now paying a higher percentage of their disposable income in mortgage interest repayments than they were when interest rates hit their peak under Paul Keating. We're quite happy to have a balanced debate about the achievements and the mistakes of the Keating government, and we're quite happy to have a debate about the achievements and the mistakes of the Howard government. And we'll be in there arguing all of these issues, irrespective of when they occur. But the one thing we are entitled to claim is that we had a lasting legacy that led to our very strong and wonderful prosperity that we've experienced over the last 16 years. And one of the big failures of the Howard government, particularly in the last 6 years, is that they've dropped the ball. And I've asked anyone in the audience to answer this question. Can anyone really name one very significant reform that they've seen from the Howard Costello government in the last 6 years? One.
Now, I never encourage speakers to ask questions because people tend to give answers.
Sure.
And it just distorts. We've had two interjections: tax reform, industrial relations reform. Don't ask him questions.
I was making a justifiable point about reform, Jeremy.
I say to all our speakers, yeah, just make the assertion, yeah.
It's simpler, okay.
Okay, so, on the other hand, maybe you'll have to ask the questions. Okay, right down the back and then further down the back and then up the front, yep. Okay.
I was interested to hear you talking about investing in education. By increasing the tests, and then we're going to find my yours somewhere. Could you give an indication as to the areas in which you would lower the priority and therefore lower the investment to pay for education?
Well, we put out a savings package through Shadow Finance Minister Lindsay Tanner about a month ago, which had savings worth $3 billion in it. There'll be more to come. No, I'm not going to name the areas where we're going to be cutting from, but they'll be out there for everybody to see well before the election. But we understand that the tax take under the Howard Costello government is high. We understand we need to be internationally competitive. We've committed ourselves to benchmarking both business and personal tax against the rest of the world on a regular basis. That's important. We understand if we're going to lift our export performance in an area like financial services, we do need to have competitive tax regimes. We're not necessarily saying low tax is good tax, but being competitive when it comes to all of the environment is very important, and tax is a very significant plays a very significant role in all of that. So business taxes do need to be internationally competitive, very important to our industry.
Now right down the back, yep.
No, they haven't, but we think trading is an important part of it because it's an asset that needs to be valued. And we will sit down and talk with the community about that framework. The problem we've had so far is the government has had its water fund out there, and most of it has been unallocated. That's not been very helpful. I also don't think it was very helpful that the government put forward its $10 billion Murray-Darling Basin package without even running it past the Treasury. So if the Treasury hasn't got an assessment of the government's Murray-Darling Basin package, then I don't think I've got a full and clear assessment of it either. It was parked out there as a matter of political convenience. I'm not convinced that it's got a lot of policy merit or worth internally, because we simply don't know. So I couldn't give you answers to all of that, and wouldn't pretend that I could.
But I'm wondering if you could give
Now, hang on.
What's the AOP policy on?
Okay, we've got it.
Well, can I just say it depends what the government is doing, because there are all sorts of rights involved in the government policy, and I wouldn't be announcing a response until I fully understood what rights they had conferred. And that would be irresponsible.
And the other question was, do you think Steve Brax would come on board with a water policy with the Labor government?
Well, I'd certainly punt on Steve Brax working very cooperatively with Kevin Rudd on not only on water, but on lots of other matters as well. As you know, the Victorian government has had a very big reform agenda when it comes to education, when it comes to national competition policy and so on. So I'm pretty confident we'd have a good working relationship. Whether we would always agree would be another thing. But we think cooperative federalism is the way ahead, given the constitutional limitations that we've got to solving problems in so many areas where there is over-regulation and duplication. Ending the blame game between the Commonwealth and the states is an important priority for us.
One of the statistics of recent note has been the increase in our baby population. The Treasurer's comments aside, but one of the vexed issues for the future, for young women whom we've educated to a very high level, and increasingly they are now choosing to have children, what are you going to do about childcare? Because it's totally, at the moment, seen as an institutional thing.
Sure.
And it's very complicated for a young woman to leave children in institutions and very expensive. What are you going to do about making it easier for young women to have childcare in the home, i.e. nannies?
Well, I think it's very important that we take some fundamental steps about the affordability of childcare as well as its supply. And I readily agree that in-home care is part of a flexible system. Whether it's affordable is entirely another question. The framework I would like to see is the maximum opportunity for one parent to be home, particularly full-time, in the first couple of years of a child's life. It's a different thing when the child starts school and a different set of issues arise, and I think there are issues there that aren't largely dealt with at the moment. All of the debate is on the under-fives, and I understand why that is. So trying to do something about the affordability problem as well as the supply problem is an important priority, but big dollars are attached. Whether we can afford to go to a model of individual care in the home is a question mark in my time in terms of... Well, I've had a good look at tax deductibility, and it's big dollars, and it doesn't necessarily produce the outcome that some people who argue for it think that it will. In doing something like that, you may actually collapse the institutional care system if you're not careful. So it's one of those very difficult problems. But as a matter of economic necessity, I agree with you that if you're going to have a productivity agenda, it has to be matched by a quality childcare agenda that enhances the capacity of a woman or a man to participate in the workforce and still fulfil their family responsibilities.
Question here, and then we go down there. Yeah.
Mr. Swan, one of the gripes of the business community about the Howard government has been the incredible extra complexity of the tax system in the last 10 years. I think the size of the Tax Act, the pages, has almost doubled under the Howard regime. It's got to the stage now, a lot of tax...
Also industrial relations.
Tax professionals find it difficult to know what's going on a lot of the time. So sometimes even the tax office does. Is this something that's on your agenda to fix?
I think the tax reform, both business and personal tax, is an important priority. But I think the best we will be doing, next budget sight unseen, of course, will be to outline our objectives in terms of reform of the tax system. We think it does need to be reformed. We think we need to do a lot about the level of complexity and also the amount of regulation that's involved. There's certainly no doubt that the personal income tax system needs some fundamental reform over the long term. But it is not achievable in one budget or two budgets or three budgets. We should have really made a lot of progress in the last couple of years, say, on the problem of very high effective marginal tax rates, which are discouraging participation, particularly from second income earners who in this country face some of the highest effective marginal tax rates in the Western world. but the government has not deemed that a priority in recent times. Untangling that is incredibly complicated, and I've come to the conclusion that it can only fundamentally in the long run be untangled if you deal with rates in the income tax system rather than tapers in the social security system. So that brings us back in the end to fundamental personal tax reform, which goes to rates. So I'd like to see that. That's my aspiration. But I won't necessarily be committing us to taking a comprehensive package in that area to the next election. It would be something that I would see that would take place over the longer term, perhaps two terms of Parliament.
Question in the middle there. Yes.
Since the new industrial relations laws came in a year or so ago, unemployment rate has gone to the lowest level for 30-odd years. Participation rate in the workforce has gone up. Unemployment rate is down. Number of people out of work down. Hours lost due to industrial disputation way down 40% or so on the year. How can you justify repealing the industrial relations laws, which promoted a more flexible, more productive workforce?
I think the greatest con job of the Howard government has been their recent claims that somehow employment growth is due to their industrial relations laws. There's not a skerrick of evidence at any level to justify that wild and stupid assertion. It is nothing more than a con job. We are getting at the moment the job growth that you would expect at this stage of the business cycle, and any economist in the room will be able to pull you out a model which shows that this is no more or no less than what you would expect in this stage of the cycle. It's got absolutely nothing to do with work choices. It's got everything to do with the mining boom, which is why the employment growth is so strong in Queensland and WA. It is why the participation rate, particularly amongst older workers, has gone through the roof in Queensland and Western Australia. It's a great thing that it's happened amongst older workers who have been the victim of employment-based discrimination and locked out of the workforce for far too long, but now come back into the workforce as a matter of economic necessity because of the mining boom. There is absolutely nothing that can justify the assertion that the job growth we've seen has got anything to do with work choices, and the final proof of that is that Peter Costello, like climate change, refuses to model it. And he himself said, actually, in the Financial Review at the end of last year that the job growth had nothing to do with work choices as well. So it's a pretty comprehensive case.
Question here, then over there.
Shadow Treasurer, apart from reiterating the comment that your government, your future government, will work more cooperatively with the states, can you give us some indication of what the low-hanging fruit will be? I mean, not just, I mean, obviously, your attempted position, the opposition at the moment, where the government is claiming that we've got all over states and all over federal government, you know, the world's going to change, but no world's going to change, it's been another. What are the opportunities that you see as the incoming
treasurer? Okay, I'll just give you a new round of competition policy. And I was around for the last lot. And it came through when I was chair of the Labor Economics Committee in the period 1993 to 1996. A lot of it was actually negotiated by Kevin Rudd, working with state premiers and the Commonwealth at the time. We do need another round of national competition policy. And it's not easy. I wouldn't describe another round of that as being low-hanging fruit. It's very high-hanging fruit, but the point about it is that it absolutely has to be done, and it lies at the core of the national reform agenda, which has been put forward by the states and particularly by people like Steve Frax. But it's one of the reasons why we haven't had that spurt in productivity we really need, because that sort of stuff has basically withered. We got a very big productivity lift out of a number of those reforms of the Hawke-Keating years, and that was a good thing, but it's petered out. So that's just one. There are many others. They're all hard. They're all hard. And we don't make any pretense about that.
Justin Ward, Insurance Australia. I sense on schizophrenia implements in relation to financial services. On the one hand, you'd like to make Sydney and other financial services in the Asia Pacific region. On the other hand, I hear in an answer to a question tonight a reference to savings plans. A part component of that savings plan was a reduction over 3 years in ASIC's budget of $3 billion. What does that say to investors in Australian financial and capital markets? And what confidence does it have in having those markets
Well, I'm quite happy to discuss that with investors. I've not heard too much from your industry in the time since when we announced that cut complaining about it, so I'm quite happy to have a talk to you about your views and take them on board. But it's the first comment I've personally had from anyone in the sector complaining about it. And that includes the government.
There's a question down the back. Yeah.
So, Treasurer, you've made a comment about the personal tax regime, business tax regime being a focus for you. What's the Labor Party's position then on the indirect tax take of the revenue stream? Does that require some modification of the
deal? No. I gave the answer to this last Friday when the Treasurer was in Canberra having a pot shot at the Premiers.
Can I make this the... Have I missed anyone? So well, you can have a... So if anyone I miss, so you can have the quick second last question. I've got the final question.
Interested in your comments on education, the importance of that. There's been a lot of reporting and talk about the dumbing down of education in Australia over the last couple of years, and that seems to be not a federal government issue, but a state government issue. And I wonder if you are to become a government, you would take that up with the states.
Too right, we will. And we made that very clear. Absolutely, and I share the concerns about some of the syllabuses that have been floating around in a variety of areas. As a parent, I find some of those trends are absolutely unacceptable. Kevin Rudd shares my view. He's on the public record expressing this in a number of areas in our home state of Queensland. We think the quality of our education should be at the highest level. We think the quality of our teachers ought to be at the highest level. And we need a series of reforms, which are not just reforms involving more money, but also structural reforms to achieve those objectives. You can't have an education revolution which doesn't go to some of these structures, some of those questions.
Just the photo. Oh, yeah, okay. Yes.
Chairman Treasurer, very interested in your analysis of the work that you think of the workplace for this one. You have information about the percentage of people employed by small business. And do you have any information about the increase in employment in the small business sector?
I simply haven't seen any recent data on that, but I know that employment in the small business sector is very important, and it's a hell of a lot of people. And I talk to small businesses and small business organisations from time to time. And they all have divergent views, I must say, when it comes to key questions about the government's industrial relations reform. Some are very strong supporters, others are very strong opponents. Generally, the opponents say they just like the certainty of the old system.
Can I make another comment?
Well, it's going to be brief, because you've already had one.
Yeah, I'll be brief. If you actually go and speak to small business owners, you will discover that they now have no concerns about the numbers of people. And they're quite happy to employ many more people because they aren't under those restrictions that they were under prior to.
Yeah, well, sadly, that's
so
not my experience.
On the unfair dismissal laws.
Yeah, sure. Well, I think there was a problem with the old unfair dismissal laws. And we're not proposing to go back to the old ones. In fact, before the package came through, we put up a series of reforms in the National Parliament to the existing unfair dismissal laws. But the government had other ideas because they had another package.
So you're saying they'd be substantially changed?
Yeah, we've made that clear. But there will be unfair dismissal laws. That's non-negotiable.
Just on the period leading up to the ALP national conference in April, I mean, how difficult is it going to be to negotiate some of these changes that you're talking about with the trade union movement and with the union delegates who will be represented on the floor? Because there seems to be widespread opposition in the union movement to any to not having an unfair dismissal law of any kind.
Well, I think I think the rights of workers demand that we have some form of unfair dismissal laws. That's just a matter of basic fairness in society. The question is, where's the balance in the laws? How far are they tilted one way or the other? we've got to get a balance between the rights of the employee and the capacity of the employer to do business, and to do it productively and to do it profitably. The old unfair dismissal laws had problems. We openly acknowledged that. We said they needed reform. We've argued that, and we'll be taking that into account, the sort of model that we develop.
Many thanks.
But I mean, but is that a problem in terms of the conference? We will go and argue our case at the conference, because we're confident that we'll get the support that we need.
Many thanks, Wayne. So I'll take a seat and we'll wrap up. But I've always liked Wayne Swan, and I've had a great deal of respect for him since he came here last time, right after the 2004 election. It was not an easy gig, but he handled himself at the State Library from memory extremely well, and I'm pleased that he's come back here in quite different circumstances, and people are obviously interested in what the Shadow Treasurer has to say, because there's a possibility there might be the Treasurer within less than a year. So Wayne Swan, as you've noticed tonight, has always been very thoughtful about economic policy. He's always been a reformist in economic policy. He's always been very hardworking. And we're seeing all that again. Best wishes in the lead up to the next election, and I'm sure whatever the result, and who knows what it might be, you're very welcome back to the Sydney Institute again. Thank you. I just want to report that Mr. Swan said returning to the Sydney Institute is the first priority. We've got that on the record. Returning after the election is the first priority. Great. You're on.